Hello to everyone. It is 12 noon on Tuesday, October 4th, and we welcome you to the CMDA monthly meeting. I don't see Jenny on yet, but I do see Chad. So I wonder if you'd like to start, Chad. We'd love to hear your announcements, and we're so glad you're here today.
All right, sure. Just a couple things. Just wanted to let folks know that we continue to hire and train new staff. So we're building our team, both in the Denver and in the Grand Junction offices. We did receive assistance from a contract survey agency. I know we've mentioned that a number of times, but they were able to complete 24 of our surveys. So a lot of our backlog, they were able to help us with as of September 30th. And moving forward, that agency will help us with another 16 surveys, recertification surveys from our backlog within the next federal fiscal year. Recent immediate jeopardy findings. We've had some instances of immediate jeopardy that have included abuse, elopement, unsafe smoking, and hazards related to the emergency preparedness program. We've been spending some time and will continue to spend some time between now and October 24th, providing surveyor education and looking at changes that are going to happen with the survey software, maybe not necessarily the survey process, but the survey software, in anticipation of the upcoming phase two revisions and phase three guidance, again, effective October 24th. And so as not to go through all of that, because if you've had an opportunity to see the advanced copy of the SOM, there's a lot in red. So red would indicate changes that are being made. Some of those changes are in language. Other parts of that that are changes may include additional examples that are being provided in terms of making compliance decisions and determining the severity, scope, severity of those changes. We're gonna see some significant changes, key areas, I guess I should say, in abuse and abuse examples, admission, transfer, discharge, mental health, substance use disorders, using the PBJ reporting during our nurse staffing investigations, resident rights, particularly around visitation, appropriate psych med use, pharmacy services, infection control, compliance ethics, arbitration agreements, cooperation, and some changes made to the psychosocial outcome severity guide. I guess, you know, just kind of moving forward in some of the conversations that were had last week and the week before, I really anticipate that there's going to be a larger emphasis placed upon the QAPI quality assurance process in terms of identifying potential issues that may result in adverse outcomes, looking at that performance improvement process, evaluation of facilities efforts to identify and address those issues and making changes where necessary, and also really feel that there's going to be a greater emphasis, added emphasis given to the emergency preparedness program. And, you know, so not in addition to making sure that all of the policies and processes are in place, but also looking to see that from a qualitative standpoint, that those policies can be implemented, that staff understand their responsibilities during an emergency situation, and then evaluating the facility's performance in response to an emergency, whether it be real or practiced, and then making changes wherever changes need to be made. So that's my update for y'all today.
Thank you. That's a lot of different topics that are very relevant to our setting. It looks like there will be changes. Is there any way that we can prepare for these or make sure that we are up to date on what's coming on October 24th?
Well, yeah, and for ourselves, it has been going through the training that CMS has provided. And again, having those kind of conversations about all that stuff that's in red, you know, there has been some good summaries out there. We've have a kind of a more higher level summary of a few of those changes. More of the major ones, I guess. But there are changes to a lot of different areas. So I really would recommend, you know, if you have that opportunity, going through those, discussing those with your facilities. And, you know, again, so you've got the kind of the day-to-day, you know, rubber hits the road kind of changes that are happening. But then there's also those changes, and that is looking at the oversight that's being provided not only by the facility leadership, but by committees like the Quality Assurance Committee and the QAPI process, and examining things from that perspective.
Thank you. I was gonna see if anyone had any questions, and it looks like Joe Tansey has your hand up. Joe, go ahead.
So I don't know if you all have received or have seen the advanced copy of the proposed regulation changes. Do you have that information?
I personally don't, but I'll start to look for it and look for the summaries, as Chad mentioned. Sure. And maybe we can share it with this audience.
Yeah, it is. It's on the CMS website. If you can't find it, let us know and we can send that to you. There still may be some changes, but I think it's pretty much clear in what those are going to be. I also did want to talk briefly about the RCF. There's going to be a new RCF coming out, hopefully this week, with the changes that CDC, to try and match up CDC and CMS changes to that guidance. So hopefully that'll be out this week. And
thank you, Joe.
Good for all of us. So that's all I wanted to add. Thanks.
Appreciate that. Yep. I think COVID and COVID mitigation is still very much on all of our minds. So we look forward to that guidance. Yeah. And maybe Jenny Albertson, who is scheduled to speak next, if you have any comments or if you'd like to go into your updates, please go ahead.
Hey, is it possible for me to share my screen, Sing?
Oh, yeah. Let me do that for you. Hold on. I know the answer is yes. I can make that happen. There you go. Just one moment. All right. Hopefully we'll do that soon, and I will stop sharing my screen so you can share yours.
Okay. I will go over what I can in a limited amount of time. It's a lot of information right now, so I'll zoom through it as much as I can.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I'm happy to share these slides so that people have the links and whatnot afterward. First of all, just to segue from what Joe was mentioning, that there are potential changes coming to our state guidelines based on CMS and CDC COVID guidance changes. What happened is on the 23rd, CDC did release an update to their overarching guidance for infection prevention and control on their website, specific to COVID-2. And CMS followed suit on the same day with updating their QSO memos on testing and visitation. Those were the primary areas they thought needed to be updated in the regulatory advisements. And then CDPHE said, wait a minute, hold, because we have to go through our red tape. And they, as Joe said, are very much active in getting their draft revision approved, and we'll have to just wait to see. There is a potential that the governor's office may have to update the public health order if that's impacted. That might potentially be part of that as well. They also released on the copy portal that they've extended the up-to-date exception beyond that October 1st date where we needed to have our clinics done. We're still pushing for the bivalent vaccination, of course, but because these changes have changed probably how up-to-date status will impact everything else, they've gone ahead and given us a little lead time between now and when they update their guidance, so that there isn't confusion, basically, as to when we're supposed to change how we treat people for up-to-date status. And so it's basically as it was until that mitigation guidance comes out. The main things that will potentially change if the state adopts what CMS and CDC has put into place is that vaccination status would no longer be used to inform source control, screening, testing, or post-exposure protocols. And the main impact changes that I think we all would immediately feel if they decide to adopt them at the state level would be no longer recommending quarantine for patients or work restriction for healthcare personnel for asymptomatic individuals following an exposure, discontinuing daily monitoring of all residents for fever or other COVID symptoms, and communal activities and dining would not be halted in the event of an outbreak. The main source control changes would happen if we are not in high levels of community transmission. Substantial and below would be liberated from masking, including universal masking. APIC is particularly upset about this and advising us to continue using universal masking as healthcare professionals. So there is a lot of debate about this, and we'll see what the state decides to do. When in high levels, we would still be doing the aerosol generating procedure protocols of N95 and eye protection during patient encounters. And of course, that would also be in place in the event of outbreak. What would be liberated, like I said, is anything below high. And then the recommendation would still be that suspected or confirmed cases, close contacts, and of course outbreak would still be using your universal source control. And as far as the screening and testing, this is also a huge deal. We would no longer be doing asymptomatic testing based on vaccination status, following what I said earlier. So in lieu of screening people at the door and in lieu of POC testing, they would want us to post visual alerts, beef up our information about infection prevention practices and instructions, and then have our own internal protocols for how we're going to ensure people notify us if they're positive, if they've been exposed, or if they have symptoms. Again, we've already had things in place at the state level that allow us to do these things in a very universal manner. So I don't know if the state will choose to change those and put it at the facility level, but that is permitted now. POC testing, we would be dropping the screening testing of personnel based on their vaccination status and just focusing on POC testing with exposure or showing of symptoms. And they would be changing it to a three-step POC test process at day 1, 2, and 5 after exposure. And shortening that potential immunity period of 90 days down to what we all have been witnessing for quite some time, that it's 30 days maximum for potential immunity from an infection. So we'd be doing POC testing for people with exposure or symptoms anywhere beyond 30 days from prior infection. And this is what CMS put into their actual verbiage around the testing. For the 30 versus 90 days. And it looks like they're really leaning on POC testing because of the need for an immediate result in order to exclude someone. So I'm not sure how this is going to, again, affect our state protocols with PCR testing being our gold standard and how they want to adjust all of that. Incoming admissions would be the other big one. Again, it would be based on community levels of transmission. You would not be quarantining those individuals, but you would subject them to that three-part test process. And they would be wearing source control for 10 days after admission. So it's like a little source control requirement, but not isolation of any sort or quarantine. And same with work restrictions. And then just another, I'm sure there's questions in the chat and I'll get to those in just a moment. Another bit of information, and then I'll give you a little workforce update. This very much impacts medical directors. There are some very significant changes happening at the ICD-10 coding level. And so your MDS coordinators and your clinicians in-house are going to be wanting to make sure they're on the same page with all treating physicians on the new coding changes. They've really beefed up the variety of codes available for dementia. And given that this is generally used across the board in some form or fashion for almost everyone with need for care, we need to know very detailed fashion what those changes are. I don't have that training mechanism prepared for anybody at this point, but you can click on the link in this and it will take you to where you need to go to see what those changes are. Obviously 28 revised codes and 251 deletions. So I'm not going to go through that here, but you will want to be educating the physicians and practitioners to make sure that they're really coding appropriately and diagnosing appropriately and in coordination with the MDS folks. It will change billing. It will change how you probably bill as well. And resolving diagnoses prior to people coming into the facility may end up being a pretty significant issue if the coding is not appropriate. Workforce update, agency use is really skyrocketing in this first quarter. You can see the blue line is us. That's all the people that are members of Colorado Healthcare Association, which is almost everyone in the state. We've gone up to a 12.1% usage in our communities, and that has really gone up quarter over quarter. So that's not good news. hours per patient per day, however, is improving. Historically, we've averaged much higher. As you can see, in 2020, we were really beefed up because of COVID, but we are gradually going back to that as best we can. 3.91 is nothing to sniff at. And turnover is worse in this state than it is in the national picture. This is not giving you anything terribly up to date. It's the end of 2021, but still our percentage of total nursing turnover is really high. And this now impacts our 5-star rating. This release from New York Times analyzing a study on workforce participation I thought was enlightening for all of us. I often get this question, where is everybody? Why aren't they coming back? COVID, of course, took out a lot of folks out of our workforce that were short of retirement age. And there's also been a very significant slowdown in legal immigration since 2017. And that's just policy. That's not necessarily COVID, obviously. People at retirement age who've been staying in the workforce longer pulled out early and retired early. And then people are still balancing the needs of childcare and not trusting the infrastructure. Of course, we know that childcare workers have also not come back in droves. So a lot of people's need for childcare is keeping them out of the workforce. CMS is still doing their staffing study on this topic. They are doing 50 initial site visits, 15 states are going to be visited, 25 follow-up validation site visits will then be done after that to kind of validate their data. They're doing on-site interviews of staff, residents, family members. They're looking at survey data, quality data. Really, this is intended to shore up their understanding of staffing minimums that they think that they adequately established with work time studies that were done many, many years ago. Like how long does it take to give someone incontinence care, for example? They actually timed people. but what I want to highlight with this is all this is going to tell us is direct care staffing, time to provide care, perception of that, and whether we all think it's adequate. We all agree it's not. But it is not going to capture the time that you spend with your patients or the additional support you give to their families. It's not going to capture social work activities, administrative support, any of the other contact that people have in a community. So unfortunately, this doesn't really capture the care that's provided. It is exclusively focused on RN, LPN, and CNA hours per patient day. And what we anticipate will come out of this is a minimum per patient day staffing standard of hours. We don't think they're going to provide a more nuanced recommendation for paralleling acuity, MDS coding, any of that. Nothing will be that complicated, I don't think. That's a double-edged sword. We like simplicity. However, again, it's not going to give us much ability to wiggle. Say, for example, you have a very high behavioral component in your community. Your staffing should be different for what you're providing to those folks as opposed to someone who is dealing with a lot of feeding tubes, trachs, et cetera. This does not give us flexibility. It just straight up looks at staff hours. Our current Colorado average staffing is 3.91, meeting a 4.1 or greater hours per patient day is going to be a significant lift, since we are already short of approximately 5,000 workers to reach our own level without agency that we're currently at. So, and that would allow us, if we got those 5,000 workers, to take admissions as we normally ought to unclog the hospital pipeline as well. On a good note, if you weren't aware, Colorado is currently paying for tuition fees and course materials for anyone who wants to get a CNA license at 19 technical colleges and community colleges around the state. It's a pretty good spread across the state. There are some counties that are in deserts, of course, as they have been, because they're not close to educational institutions. But this is great news. It's active, it just started. And it's very simple for people to simply apply through the regular college system that's existing in their community. We already have members utilizing this for applicants. And that is it. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for all those very thoughtful updates. I know we need to move along, but I was wondering if you don't mind if I not send the slides out just yet until we can confirm what we are going to do in Colorado for the COVID mitigation. And maybe sure. That'll... decrease any sort of different versions of any changes. Yeah. Are there any quick questions for Jenny? I'm going to go ahead. Okay. Well, why don't we go on to Dr. Gom's presentation? Let me see if I can't try to share this for you.
Now comes the really exciting stuff.
I know, right? Okay, hopefully you're seeing your slides, Greg.
Oh, they popped right up. Good.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I'll just let you guess when to change them, and we'll just work through this. So we can go past this. We're going to talk about vaccines, and really we're going to talk about COVID and influenza. But the very first thing is the most important thing that we missed with COVID vaccination all the way through. And it's always been true of influenza, and people seldom recognize it. It's true for every respiratory virus. The purpose of the vaccine is never to prevent the disease. People get infected, and then they trigger a robust response if they've been, now you can flip it, just touch any key. You want to get a quicker, more robust response that decreases your risk for serious illness and death. And if there's one thing that the population has missed in the, you know, throughout COVID, this is it. So there really is no such thing as a breakthrough infection. It's supposed to happen. You get COVID vaccines, you stay up to date, you're supposed to get infected. And then you just get a robust response. And most of the time it goes away. You don't get sick. You don't go to the hospital and you don't die. That's the purpose. Okay. Now we can move on. Let's talk about COVID first, the bivalent booster. This has been really interesting because we knew this was coming. And so the researchers were doing research with the Omicron BA1 spike protein and enlisted people. It showed pretty good data, a little bit better data than, obviously better than placebo, marginally better than the original vaccine. But when it came right down to it, by May, BA1 had all but disappeared. BA4 was prominent, BA5 was coming on strong, and now BA5 is the predominant thing. So the FDA said, even though the research was looking at the BA1 spike protein with the original, let's have the manufacturers make the bivalent protein with a segment from the BA4/5 spike protein. And go to the next slide, which is, and actually, I'll make one more comment on that. The vote was 19-2 in favor of approving the bivalent booster. The two people that voted against it, one of them was Paul Offit, who is really one of the key vaccine people in this country. And he said, well, two problems with it. Number one, it was barely better than the just giving another booster of the original. And he said, and what makes it worse is we didn't look at BA4 and 5. We looked at BA1. So we're assuming that it would have the same response. We don't know. Nonetheless, that's all background. The bivalent booster was approved August 31st. The Pfizer vaccine is good for anybody over 11, Moderna over 17. Click. Okay.
Right, I'm not sure if it's me or if it's your end. I didn't hear your last.
No, you can click on anything. It should just move on. There you go. You give the booster anytime more than 2 months after the primary vaccine or previous booster, or if you've had, now click again, or if you've had COVID. You have to do a primary series. Somebody that's never been vaccinated, you can't just start with the bivalent booster. You have to go through the original series first and then get it. And I don't know if I put it on a slide or not, but if you've had COVID in the past couple months, I know that there CDC and others are saying you can get the bivalent 30 days, 60 days after. I'm still a proponent of waiting the full 90 days. I think the purpose of these boosters is as much to wake up your memory B and memory T cells and your plasma X immune cells as it is to get just another quick little boost in your antibodies. So I'm in favor of waiting the full 90 days and then getting it. But click, next slide. The monovalent vaccines that we were using no longer authorized as boosters, which led to this really funny situation in early September where we had no boosters that we could give anybody because at the same date they said bivalent booster is approved. They took away the EUA for the original boosters, but the bivalent boosters weren't yet ready. I think we should have enough by now to get pretty much everybody that's interested, which unfortunately is still just a small segment of the population. But no more mRNA monovalent vaccine boosters. Okay. Novavax is a really, if you read the science of how they did this, how they made the vaccine, it is exciting, and my guess is that it will find its main use in the coming months as a booster, but it is not yet approved as a booster. When it comes out, I'll just tell you that I will be getting it. And again, because it complements what's already happened, it's made a little bit different way, and it includes, we're going to talk a little bit about adjuvant vaccine for influenza in a little bit. It includes an adjuvant, so it works a little bit differently, and I think it's a pretty good stimulant for the immune system. Okay. So as of right now, if up to date still matters, and it does clear up until we get all these changes from CMS and the mitigation guideline changes, and it may make a difference down the road. But the only way to technically be up to date is to have the bivalent booster. Doesn't matter how many boosters you got before, or if you didn't get any, the only thing that counts is the bivalent booster. Right now today, the only other way to be up to date would be to have never gotten a vaccine and just start getting the vaccine series. And at that point in time, you're 2 weeks out after the second dose, you're up to date for 60 days. And then as soon as that 60 days is up, you need the bivalent or you would no longer be up to date. Okay. There we go. I already said that. So we can go to the next one. Okay, let's jump to influenza. There are four vaccine components now in every flu vaccine. Of the four, it's the AH3N2 that causes the most serious illness and death in seniors. H1N1 is primarily kids. In the two B strains, change every 10 years, and they just kind of hang around in the background. They're here at low levels year round. So you can get people with the, if you test for them, now that we do these rapid panels with all testing for everything, we see influenza B in May and July and August and throughout the year. But it's seldom epidemic. It's really the AH3N2. That's the one we want to focus on. Watch, this year's component is new. The H3N2 changes about every 2 years. So that just tells us there's not going to be a lot of background immunity. So if it weren't for COVID, you would say this should be a worse than normal year. With COVID, I don't know what to tell you, that it's going to be a bad year, or COVID is going to have a new strain come up and predominate and through viral interferon maybe have another mild flu season. I don't know. I'm assuming it will be at least an average year, if not worse than average. Next. When do you give a vaccine? Anytime now is fine for staff, younger persons that are not immunocompromised. For normal people, adults that aren't immunocompromised, the typical flu vaccine, you'll maintain immunity for an entire year. In teenagers, youth, how nice is it to be young? That immunity lasts about 18 months. For residents, anybody over 65 or immunocompromised, I always recommend waiting till November or December. The ACIP is finally coming around to the same sort of opinion, although they do recommend vaccinating by the end of October. But my contention is that's because the community population is not captive. Our population is captive. In Colorado, we almost never, it's not always, but almost never see influenza here before mid-January. So the sooner you give the vaccine, typically 90 days is when that immunity starts waning for older folks. And you don't want to give the vaccine so early that by the time flu gets here, the immunity is waning. So, you know, just November or December, anytime is a fine time to give flu vaccine to the residents. Next. Said the first part. Oh, I already said that. All right, we can keep going. You can give both if you want. You can give COVID and influenza vaccines at the same time. There are at least two studies going on right now that are actually combining them into a single vaccine. And I think as we go forward, maybe even as early as next year, that's what we'll see. We give MMR, which is three different antigens. We give Tdap, we give all kinds of combined vaccines. And I think that that's what we'll see with COVID and influenza. For anybody immunocompromised or over 65, they need to be getting either high dose or adjuvant vaccine. For the first time this year, the ACIP went ahead with that and made that a formal recommendation. They've been hinting that they think it's a good idea for about 5 or 6 years, and now they finally come through and said, yes, it is what you should do. High dose is really just, by the way, if you run out of high dose or can't get it, and you have a lot of standard dose, you can give four doses of the standard dose and get exactly the same vaccine. It's just four times the antigen. And the only difference between the two is how much saline you give it in. Adjuvant vaccine is interesting. It uses a thing called MF59, which is, think of it as oil and water. So you have saline in this oil. You give the dose, and instead of, you know, spheres of water that you get with the high dose or a standard vaccine, you ended up with this flat plate-like separation of the vaccine, which the theory is that gives your immune system a broader area to see the antigen and respond. Nonetheless, they're about even from what I can tell and reading through the research done on them. They're equally effective. Use one or the other. You can give either of them in any reasonable muscle mass. they're recommending right now, you separate, if you give them both together, separate them by an inch, and that's just to tell which one they react to. I don't think that's terribly important. And I'll just throw in that, I will throw out that normally people give it in deltoid, and I think in a lot of our older folks, that's just a needle going straight through to hit the shoulder pretty quick and hit bone, and it's painful. I always give these in the triceps. You can pinch the triceps, give the shot right there. It's a bigger muscle mass, hurts less, people complain less, and it works just as well or better. Next. So what happens as we get to this year and we start seeing people with respiratory infections? You know, one thing, the ventilate thing there just says, on a warm day from now till April, if it's a nice day, open the doors and windows, get the air. I mean, all the bad air is on the inside, the good air is on the outside. So get the air moving through the facility. Remember that there's a difference between airborne and aerosolized viruses. And if the two, you know, COVID aerosolized primarily, so it typically is attached to water vapor, and it does what water does when you cough it out. It's attached to it, and gravity takes the water to ground, which is why we do social distancing, and we don't do that with influenza. Influenza is airborne. You cough it out. It's not attached to water droplets primarily, so it can spread in a reasonable inoculum over a much larger distance, and it can stick around. And RSV, again, airborne. Airborne also goes right through a mask. Surgical masks aren't terribly good at stopping it. Aerosolized viruses get stopped by masks because the water there gets absorbed by the mask, and it does go further. Hand washing, it'd be really nice someday if CMS, CDC, FDA came through and said, you know, hand washing is really important for GI stuff, but it really has nothing to do with COVID. And that's a sort of personal opinion here. We just don't have any data showing that what you'd have to do would, you'd almost intentionally have to try to give yourself COVID to get it from your hands, but that's for another day. Next. So when we get folks show up with fever, cough, you know, typical respiratory stuff, what are you going to do? It's going to be hard to tell them apart. The only thing I'd tell you is that influenza, if you have somebody, first of all, if it's a bunch of people all at once, five or six people in a unit that come down within 12 hours with a high fever or cough, it's probably influenza. It's just the rapidity of the onset and the high fever and this cough that came out of nowhere and how rapidly that comes on, that's really a good clue for influenza. If you see that, start Tamiflu or Relenza, do it quickly, and then you'll test. Now we know, all know how to do appropriate testing. You'll test for both, and if it comes back negative for influenza, you can always stop. But because Tamiflu and Relenza don't treat flu, they help prevent it, prevent spread, you got to get them on quick. I'm not going to say anything about prophylaxis. If you have questions in a particular unit, you have an outbreak, let me know. And the reason for that is in an individual patient that might be exposed, there's evidence that it probably is a pretty good idea. The problem is amantadine and rimantadine are now essentially useless because we overused them, and Tamiflu resistance is gaining. So it becomes a balance of weighing. You know, the more Tamiflu we use now, the less likely we're going to have it available here in a couple of years. It's interesting, Relenza is really hard to get, but it works faster, and there's no resistance building to it. So I don't know why we don't use more, but anyway, feel free to reach out if you have questions about prophylaxis. Next. And that is it. And for those of you really astute, these are actually those three viruses, COVID, RSV, influenza. Questions?
Yeah, thank you so much, Greg. Thanks for putting all this together for us. There was a question sent to me that to ask you. Where did it go? It was a when or and if COVID is not an issue, do you think we will always deem masks at this time of the year for influenza?
Well, I'm not sure I know when COVID's not going to be an issue. So that's the bigger question. If COVID were not an issue, I think probably what we'll see is not good research. We'll just see people jump to conclusions and say, hey, we had two pretty mild seasons and people were wearing masks, let's just keep wearing them. And they'll attribute it to influenza. And the only thing I can say, back in 2004, there were some really elaborate studies done where they took people with influenza and they put masks on them and had them blow up balloons. And in fact, they had them stack masks, and it got up to 6 surgical masks. And then they calculated how many virions made it inside these balloons. And there was no difference. Same number of influenza virions with no mask or with 6 surgical masks stacked up. So, you know, that's the only research I've seen. And that would tell you that they don't really do a good job, but they do make people think, I guess, about what they're doing. And they do protect against COVID. So I think it'll be a while before they go away.
Thank you. Okay. Well, if there are any other questions, please feel free to put them in the chat box for Dr. Gom. I'll go ahead with our next topic, which should take about 5 minutes. And the topic is treating venous thromboembolism. This is a general overview of the CHEST guidelines that came out in 2021 about antithrombotic therapy for VTE disease or venous thromboembolic disease. And if you want a copy of that, you can just scan this QR code. It is open source, it's online, and it's also 65 pages long. I'll go right into it. The one of the first recommendations was just about the proximal leg DVT. That's when you have a thrombosis in the popliteal vein, femoral, iliac, or the IVC. And because of the risk for those types of DVTs to become pulmonary embolism and to have complications, they recommend anticoagulation for 3 months. After 3 months, extended phase therapy is recommended if there are risk factors present. And I have a slide about this in just a moment. For distal leg DVTs, or DVTs that are in the peroneal vein or one of the tibial veins, you don't have to automatically go to anticoagulation. One option is to do serial ultrasound on a weekly basis for 2 weeks. And I know that that can be a big challenge right now for our patients in long-term care facilities and with staffing challenges all around. But if the person has severe symptoms from the distal DVT, or if the thrombus does extend on serial imaging, then anticoagulation for 3 months would be recommended. And after that, extended phase therapy if there are risk factors present. For superficial vein thrombosis, the thinking used to be that they're all pretty benign, but they can embolize and they can be complications as DVTs or PEs. So the recommendation now are to consider anticoagulation for SVTs for 45 days. And you would consider this especially if it's an extensive clot, if it's above the knee, especially if it involves the greater saphenous vein, if there are severe symptoms like pain and swelling, or if the person has a history of thrombosis, an active cancer, or recent surgery. For pulmonary embolism, the name of the game seems to be risk stratification. So there are PEs that don't even require anticoagulation. If someone has a subsegmental PE and there is no proximal leg DVT, anticoagulation is not necessarily recommended. There are also these risk calculators like the PESI, the Pulmonary Embolism Severity Index, and also the simplified PESI. And when you go online, there are several different calculators you can use that calculate the person's 30-day mortality based on their age, their comorbidities, and their vital signs. And using one of these calculators, if someone has a low risk, they can be treated for their PEs outside of the hospital. The anticoagulation duration is 3 months. with a consideration for extended phase therapy if there are risk factors present. And if people have more intermediate or a high risk based on their PESI scores, they should initially be treated in the hospital so that they have access to thrombolysis or hemodynamic monitoring if needed. So what's this extended phase therapy? We offer treatment beyond 3 months for people who have a DVT or a PE with persistent provoking factors, or if it was unprovoked and we don't know what that is. Oh, someone, I want to mute somebody. I want to mute their phones. For extended phase therapy, there is no predefined stop date. And one thing that I think I could do better, and we could do better in our long-term care facilities, is we need to reevaluate these patients on an annual basis. Look at the risk and benefits of ongoing anticoagulation, and also look at the values and preferences of the patient. And in actuality, the studies looking at extended phase therapy for VTEs only go to 2 to 4 years. And beyond 4 years, the risks and benefit are actually uncertain. So we would not offer extended phase therapy to people who have had a VTE with a transient provoking factors. And some of those examples are listed here, like someone who's recently had surgery, or if they were acutely hospitalized for an illness, and that was the provoking factor. As long as it's been 3 months and that factor is transient and resolved, they can come off of anticoagulation. The guidance from CHEST also talks about what type of anticoagulation to consider. And you can see for DVT or PE, the DOACs are the treatment of choice. For SVT, it's a little different. It's fondaparinux or rivaroxaban. You can see on this table, there are different recommendations for VTE related to malignancy or antiphospholipid syndrome. And for extended phase therapy, the recommendation is actually to continue using a reduced dose of a DOAC. Now, I mentioned that the CHEST guidelines are 65 pages long. I think it's better used as a reference. But if you want a half hour concise review of those guidelines, the New England Journal of Medicine interviewed one of the creators of the guideline, Dr. Lisa Moore, and that's available at this link here. And thank you very much. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to take them in the chat box and we can go ahead and move on to the next part of our meeting. Okay. And I will go ahead and let Allison take it away. Allison, did you want me to share my slides or do you want me to show them from my computer?
Oh yeah, can you share them? That'd be awesome. But I'm just gonna kind of cruise through it quickly. I just wanted to give you guys all an update on the AMDA on the Hill. So Dr. Eber, Dr. Powell, and myself are on the AMDA board, and every September they go and they have AMDA on the Hill Day, where we get to go and meet with our Congress people. And we usually go with three different asks. And so I just wanted to kind of share with you guys the things that we asked for this year. So we went on September 15th. That's why that date is there. You can do the next slide. So the first thing, and it was really timely, this is exciting. The first thing that we asked for is for our representatives and senators to really support legislation to ensure that nursing homes are reporting and giving data on their medical directors and have that available in Nursing Home Compare. And this is something that AMDA has been lobbying for I think they said a decade. And that day that we were on the Hill was really exciting. A resolution was introduced that requires nursing homes to report medical directors to CMS, who must publish that data on the care compare tool. And this is a great thing for transparency, and also would have been, I think, as we all know, really handy during the pandemic as data and information was changing. We had no way to really get information out quickly. And so this will be really helpful for that. So I think it was California and Pennsylvania, so it has bipartisan support. So that was introduced. So that's something to keep an eye on. The second thing we asked for, you could do the next slide, is looking at the payment system, really asking them to kind of put pause on the budget neutrality cuts that we were facing. And I don't remember the day. It wasn't the same day. It wasn't as timely and exciting, but there is another resolution that has been introduced, which will stop that 4.42% budget neutrality adjustment on the physician fee schedule. So that's another thing to kind of keep an eye on. And then the third thing that we met and talked to them about was looking at the provider shortage in our space and asking them to really authorize or support a GAO or a MedPAC study to kind of look at why we have the provider shortage and what are the elements and barriers to getting providers in our space. And it was fun. We have just a few pictures to share. I know we're really tight on time, but I'll share. We got, so I got to do the Ways and Means Committee with a couple of, that's Dr. Nace and Dr. Steinberg there. And then there's Leslie and Singh and I outside Bennett's office. So it's fun getting to meet with them and being on the Hill and seeing all the action. Here is Dr. Pallet with Nick Bright. Is that him or is it that his LA thing?
And that's the head staffer for head Jonah staff. Goose's office.
Yeah, and then here's Dr. Eber and Dr. Pallet outside Hickenlooper's office. And then I think here's the group from AMDA, or at least half of us. We had two group photos, but it's just really neat because we're all board members from across the United States. And so we're meeting with all sorts of different representatives and senators and asking for these things as a collective. So it's really exciting and really fun. And I think, one more picture. That was the Library of Congress, right?
Yep.
Yep. That's cool. Yeah, I didn't get to go in there, but that looked cool. So just wanted to keep you guys kind of up to date on some of the policy stuff that AMDA works on. And that is all, I think. Just a brief thing.
Thank you. Thank you so much for summarizing that. It was a fun trip. Now I will turn it over to Leslie, and we will start introducing our CMDA board member candidates.
Thank you, Singh, and thanks, Allison. So this is our election for board candidates at large. And I just want to remind you that you're all welcome to vote if you're active CMDA members. And so the time is not run out. You still can become an active CMDA member. And your vote will be electronically sent to you after this meeting. And so we have three candidates. Rebecca Jackson, who was unable to be here today. And so she has an introduction by Roger Bingham, and we'll get to Roger in just a second. And then we also have Dr. Raj Rai and Alicia Smith. So we're really thrilled to have three candidates to be our new members at large. So Dr. Bingham, do you want to read Dr. Jackson's information?
I guess not.
Is he on the call?
I don't know. Let's take a look. Do you happen to have a copy of it, Singh?
I do, yeah. Yeah, if you'd like to.
You read it?
I wonder if we'd want to start with Alicia because she is on the call. I'd be happy to pull up and read Dr. Jackson's statement.
Wonderful. Alicia, would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thank you. If you can't hear me, just let me know. Sometimes my internet is a little tricky, but
okay.
I'm Alicia, and I have been a PA since 2004. And I grew up in Colorado, so I'm a native. I've been here my whole life, and I went to CU for my undergrad. I got a degree in psychology, and then went to PA school at Red Rocks, like I said, graduated in 2004. And then I've pretty much been geriatrics my whole career. So I was with the Senior Care of Colorado, and then IPC, and now I'm with Rocky Mountain Senior Care. And I've been at Rocky Mountain since 2012. So I'm working part-time right now, mainly at Covenant Living in Westminster. And I'm just interested in being more involved in the group. And I'm really more interested in the education side of things, the conference, and maybe some other educational things that you all are working on. The policy side is interesting to me. That would be a new area for me to delve into. But yeah, I'm just excited to be a little more involved and help out with what's going on with the board.
Thank you so much, Alicia. We are so thrilled that you threw your hat in, and we are so excited to work with you. Now for Dr. Raj Rai. Unfortunately, he had a sudden urgency and he's not able to be with us today, but he sent us a statement that I'd like to read for you, and I'm just going to pull it up. Hello, everyone. I am a wound care and addiction medicine physician. I have spent the last 8 years here in Colorado after spending 5 years pre-residency working at the University of Colorado. I trained in general surgery in Atlanta and then in burn surgery in New York. When I completed my training, I briefly moved to Chicago and then ultimately back to Colorado, where I live with Anna, our two children, our two dogs, and a lot of fish. Over the past several years, I have learned the value of caring for my patients by looking through a lens that is mission-driven to provide care to those who cannot always properly care for themselves. I currently run three practices, one, ProHealth One, wound care, two, Magnolia Medical, addiction and behavioral health, and three, Fort Health and Wellness Primary Care. Joining CMDA gives me the opportunity to not only be involved with amazing network of colleagues whom I can learn from, but also share some of my experiences and resources with others. I am excited to be more involved, and I'm grateful for the honor. Sincerely, Raj. And so that is his statement about why he wants to be more involved. And then Singh, would you like to read Dr. Rebecca Jackson? That'd be great.
Yes. Yes, Dr. Rebecca Jackson is a Northern Colorado native who grew up in Windsor, went to college at Colorado State, and returned to Fort Collins after medical school for her residency in family medicine. She later went to OHSU in Portland for her geriatric fellowship and returned in 2014 and has served as Columbine Health System's medical director since that time. She's the founder of Front Range Geriatric Medicine, a small provider group providing medical services for Columbine's 5 skilled nursing facilities and 3 assisted livings. She also provides medical direction for several Columbine ancillary services, including Front Range Therapy, Pooter Infusion Therapy, and Columbine Pooter Home Healthcare. A key lesson I learned, Dr. Jackson learned during the pandemic, is the importance of advocacy for our residents and the setting we work in. CMDA has not only been a resource, but a community for me over the past few years. I'm excited at the opportunity to give back and be more involved in CMDA. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Singh. So we have 3 candidates and we're very honored that they've all considered to donate their time and expertise to CMDA. You'll be getting a voting opportunity in your email. If you would like to vote and you're not yet a member, it's easy to do. You can just go to our website, cmda.us, and you can join us. We look forward to the voting results. They will go from today until Friday, I believe, at midnight. Is that correct?
Yes.
So you have some time to vote, and we look forward to sharing the results with you. I'll hand it back to Singh.
Yeah, thank you so much, Leslie. Very excited about our new board members. At this time, it is just about 1 o'clock. We had one more item planned for this meeting, and we welcome everyone to stay if you can. I'll let Allison go ahead with this. We have a membership poll that has been emailed out to everyone, but we are also giving you the opportunity to participate in the poll live right now.
I'm going to go ahead and launch the poll, and I've not actually done this before, so it works. Okay, so I'm going to launch it, and do you guys see 3 questions?
Yep.
No, nothing popped up, huh?
I see it.
Oh, you see it. Oh, okay.
Okay, great. Okay, good. So you guys should be able to just work through. It is anonymous. No one sees your answers. And I'll just keep this poll open until a few minutes after 1, and then we can close it. So does anybody who's still on the call and wants to participate? Singh, I think we were also going to resend the email link.
Yes, I'm happy to do that. So we give many people the opportunity to give feedback.
Yeah. We just want to make sure we're meeting at the best time for everybody. So that is the membership poll.
Thank you so much. As soon as that poll is completed, that will be the end of our meeting today.
Well, I'll just leave it open and